3. Martin and Roy materialize just outside the door of Martin's warehouse in London/Camelot. There were a few more people milling around, but it was after dark in the 12th century, so a street in a large city like this looked pretty much the same as the street in the medium-sized town they'd just left. Martin said,
"So, this is Camelot. Not much to look at in the dark, I know. You'll see a lot more of it in the next few days."
Martin opened the door to his warehouse and motioned for the older man to come inside. They walked into a large open room, about one-third of the overall volume of the building. The walls were painted black. The wooden floor was also painted black, except for a blood-red pentagram inside a circle. At the points of the inverted star, there were candles. They lit themselves as Roy entered the room, which startled him. Martin shrugged as he closed the door.
"Yeah, they do that whenever someone who isn't me comes in. If it bothers you, I can make them not notice you. It just takes a little programming."
The corners of the room were home to 4 10-foot-tall stone statues of fearsome creatures undreamt of in this time's primitive mythology. Each creature stood atop a pedestal that also bore the creature's names, which were all unfathomable to the ears of the locals. The far end of the chamber was not a wall, but a red velvet curtain. Roy pointed at it and said,
"Looks like you stole it from a movie theater."
"I did. I worked there when I was in high school. The manager was an awful racist jackass. Now he's a racist jackass who has to explain to the owner how he let someone steal a huge velvet curtain."
As they walked across the room, Roy asked who or what the monstrous statues were supposed to be. Martin pointed to each, listing their names.
"Optimus Prime, Boba Fett, Grimace, and the Stig."
Roy said, "Yeah, I can read. Are those names supposed to mean something to me?" Martin had nearly reached the velvet curtain, but stopped and looked at his trainee, genuinely puzzled.
"None of them ring a bell? Not even Grimace?"
Roy shook his head.
"What year are you from?"
Martin asked.
1973.
"Wow,"
Martin said.
"Seriously? Huh."
Martin took a moment to absorb this, then said,
"Well, none of these guys existed yet in 73, except Grimace, and he probably looked pretty different. Did you ever eat at McDonald's?"
Roy said,
"No."
Martin asked,
"Why not?"
"Because I'm a grown man,"
Roy answered. Martin shrugged and parted the curtain. He gestured toward the gap and said,
"After you."
Roy walked through the curtain into Martin's living quarters, which took up the remaining two-thirds of the building. The walls were bare wood and plaster. The ceiling was a tangle of timber rafters. The floor was raw planks. The space between the walls, the floor, and the ceiling was filled mostly with furniture from IKEA. The layout was what designers in Martin's time called open-plan living. It was one space. The bedroom was distinct from the living area and the dining area, but they were delineated from one another not by walls or partitions, but by where and how the furniture was placed. Now Roy looked confused.
"You live in a barn?"
Martin smiled as he breezed past Roy.
"Pretty much. I mean, the building is in town, so I think of it as a warehouse, but before I bought it, this building's main job was to keep hay dry before it was fed to horses. So, yeah, I guess that pretty much makes it a barn."
Martin walked to his work table and watched Roy explore his living space. The furniture was loosely clustered together in a little over half of the room. The rest of the room was open and empty. Roy walked around the dining room table and chairs, then stopped and asked where the kitchen was.
"Don't have one. We don't really need to cook. Are you hungry?"
Martin asked.
"No, Pete gave me some mutton. He said it was on the house."
Martin remembered that when he'd arrived, the only thing Pete had given him on the house was an assortment of threats and insults. Roy moved on to the color-coordinated couch and easy chairs. They were modern, comfortable, and small enough to be easily maneuvered by one man. He slowly walked toward something he clearly didn't recognize,
It was a large, flat slab of black glass and plastic, mounted vertically on a base that sat on top of a wooden cabinet.
"What's that?"
he asked. "That's my TV," Martin said. He picked up a remote control and aimed it at the slab. It played a little jingle and displayed a spinning Samsung logo. Martin turned it off. "There are no TV channels here, of course, but I use it to watch old movies from time to time."
Roy turned to Martin and in a quiet voice asked,
"What year are you from?"
Martin chuckled. 2012. Have a seat, Roy.
Roy sat heavily in one of the easy chairs. Martin looked at his closed laptop, thinking he'd give Roy a little more time to adjust before hitting him with that. He got up from his desk and sat on the couch opposite Roy.
"So," Martin asked, "what happened?"
"Huh?"
Roy said, snapping out of his daze.
"What brings you to medieval England? And how the heck did you manage to find the file in 1973?
"Nobody else from the 70s is here?"
"No. Until you, the earliest year anyone had come here from was 1984, as far as I know."
Roy puffed up a bit.
"So I found it first."
"Yes," Martin said. "But you got here last, so you can decide for yourself what that's worth."
Roy thought about that, then continued.
"I was an engineer at Lockheed. It's a company that makes airplanes."
Martin said,
"It's called Lockheed Martin in my time. Always kind of got my attention."
"I bet. Anyway, I worked in a division called the Skunk Works."
"Really?"
"Yeah. We mainly did top secret work for the government."
"I know!"
"High-speed, high-altitude stuff."
"I know!"
"Top-secret projects."
"I know!"
"Look, kid," Roy snapped. "Do you want me to tell you the story, or do you already know it?"
Martin put his hands up.
"Sorry, please. Go on."
"Okay. So back in 65, we got ourselves a computer, an IBM 360. We didn't know what the heck we were going to do with it, but everyone figured those things were the future, so they ordered me to learn how to run the thing. I studied and experimented for a while. The company had a few more of them sitting around in other divisions. All of the magnetic tapes for the whole company were stored in one room. One day, I decided to see what other divisions are using the stupid thing for, so I just start loading up all of the tapes in there, one by one. One of the tapes has a file on it that appears to be larger than the tape could hold. That got my attention."
"Understandably," Martin said. "How much could one of those tapes hold?"
170 megabytes,
Roy answered.
"What's so funny?"
Martin said,
"Nothing. Please, go on."
"Okay. So I load up the file, and I get a print of the first few thousand characters. It looks like a database."
"And eventually you realized what you were looking at?"
"Yes,"
Roy said.
"Proof that the world and everyone and everything in it is just a program controlled by a computer."
"And you had a file that could control the computer that controlled the world."
Martin leaned forward and asked,
"What did you do next?"
"I thought about giving myself a bunch of money, but I thought that was probably the fastest way to get caught."
Martin decided to never tell Roy how he had gotten caught. Roy continued,
"I decided to use the database to give myself an advantage at work, make my prototype stronger, boost the output of my team's engine designs. I told everyone my secret was advanced computer modeling."
"Smart. Did it work?"
"For a while. There was one project I'd really put my heart into, the A-12. It was a spy plane. It needed to fly very high and very fast. Later, they added a seat and called it the SR-71.
"You worked on the Blackbird?"
Martin blurted in spite of himself. Roy smiled.
"Is that what they call it?"
"Yeah, eventually, I guess. It went like Mach 3, didn't it?"
"Officially. It could go a bit faster if it had to."
Martin leaned back heavily into his seat.
"Wow! The SR-71! I had a poster of it in my bedroom! I always wondered how they managed to make something like that clear back in the 60s.
It was a long, awkward pause as Martin's smile faded.
"And now you know," Roy said. "The damn Russians were just so much better with titanium than we were. I thought having good intelligence would prevent wars in the long run, so I found ways to make the plane work. Then I found ways to make it work better. I just got carried away.
And that's how you got caught? Martin asked.
Roy grimaced and said,
I moved to a different project. Then they tried to build more SR-71s. It was top secret, and I wasn't on the team anymore, so I didn't know what was happening. They couldn't get the titanium parts to bond. Eventually, they started asking questions.
And you pictured yourself having a long talk with the CIA, so you decided to get lost.
Bingo. I'd read a book that had just come out, The Best Years to Live in Medieval England, by some guy named Cox. That was a gift. Anyway, I snuck into the chart room and grabbed the coordinates for the Cliffs of Dover, made a side trip to the computer room, entered the coordinates, picked a date, and that's how I got here.
Martin considered this for a moment, then asked, So, where's your computer?
Roy squinted.
I don't own a computer. I'm just a guy.
What about the computer you used to get here?
Roy kept squinting.
That's Lockheed's computer.
Whatever, Martin said. Where is it?
Where I left it. At the Skunk Works.
Martin had difficulty absorbing what he was hearing. You didn't bring it with you. Roy! Oh, man. It was a one-way trip for you.
Like I said, kid, I panicked.
Without a computer here, how'd you plan to pass yourself off as a wizard?
I didn't, Roy said, chuckling. I figured I'd use my engineering background to make a living. I walked into that bar, they took one look at me, and assumed I was a wizard.
Yeah, Martin agreed. I bet they did.
Martin spent the next hour laying out the situation for Roy in much the same way Philip had done for him. He explained that there were communities of wizards all over Europe in this time, and in various other places at other points in history. He told Roy that all of the wizards were guys like them, who had stumbled across the file in one of its many forms, gotten into trouble using it, and come back in time as a means of hiding. They spent some time puzzling over the fact that while everyone else had found the file on some corporate mainframe, Roy had found it on a magnetic memory tape. But Martin eventually dismissed the topic as just one of the many things about the file and the universe itself that seemed counterintuitive. Martin explained that women who find the file all ended up going to Atlantis, as life everywhere else wasn't particularly hospitable for women with magic powers. Martin was just explaining about chronological pollution and how nothing they did to the past seemed to have any effect on the future when Roy interrupted him by snoring. Martin roused Roy just long enough to get him set up to sleep on the couch. As he tucked a sheet set into the cushions, Roy asked,
When do I get to meet the guy in charge?
The guy in charge, Martin thought. There's a thorny issue.
For a moment, Martin considered telling Roy about how the current chairman had only held that position for a short time, and how the chairman before had changed his name from Jimmy to Merlin, and then tried to reshape the entire country according to his whims, which included trying to kill all of the other wizards.
Nah, Martin thought. That's a little too heavy to drop on him on the first night. I'll explain the whole thing later, when we talk about banishment.
Martin answered,
I don't know when you'll meet the chairman. It'll happen at some point, but it's hard to say when. He's a busy guy.